in the analysis, the place where you face the experience of otherness, the experience of foreignness, the experience of the unconscious that goes through you, it doesn't appear as knowledge. Of course, in an analysis, you get a lot of knowledge, but it's not the important aspect of an analysis. I think that in the analysis, and that's the idea of using that word transmission instead of teaching, what you receive is something that the analyst doesn't have. When you receive some knowledge from a teacher, you receive the knowledge the teacher has. When you transmit something, or when you receive something that has been transmitted by the analyst or by the psychoanalytical setting, if you want, is something that the other doesn't have. It's a kind of void. It's a kind of fire, if you want. It's like the
baton
that every runner pass to other in relay race. Is something more difficult to be grasped with words. Is something elusive to words, but it does exist.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Mariano Orenstein. Dr. Orenstein is a training and supervising analyst, and he is a member of the IPA, FAPAL, the Latin American Psychoanalytical Federation, and the international research group Geographies of Psychoanalysis. He is currently serving as one of the representatives of Latin America on the IPA's board. Our conversation today revolves around his book, The Compass and the Couch, Psychoanalysis and Its Necessary Foreignness. I won't go into the details because I introduce it when we begin speaking. Suffice it to say that it is a book of prose that has a great deal of resemblance to poetry. It's 34 little vignettes, essays, pieces of pleasure that are no longer than 2 to 5 pages each. And it really gives us an experience to see how a thoughtful analyst approaches one's encounter and relationship with the unconscious. Mariano has written widely. His articles have also been translated widely. He's the author of 4 books, and he's received many international awards, including the M. Birkwick about the clinical forms of evil, the Lucian Freud Award about psychoanalysis and culture, the Elise Hyman Award for the study of Holocaust and genocide given by the IPA, A. Garma Award given by the Spanish Association of Neuropsychiatry, and the FIPAL Award and Carolina Zamora Award given by the Madrid Psychoanalytic Association. I found his work and his thinking to be quite refreshing and quite invigorating, and I hope you do as well. Here is my conversation with Dr. Mariano Orenstein. Mariano, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. Mariano, I've been thinking about how to characterize your book for the listener who may not be familiar with it. And it's a book that consists of 34 pieces, small pieces, from 2 to 5 pages each. And the first characterization that came to my mind was to consider it poetry. And as the listener will soon hear, there are certainly poetic aspects to it, but it is prose, and I think the prose needs to be honored for both what it is and how beautiful it is. And what I settled upon was to consider it, for me, a collection of amuse-bouche, delightful little appetizers that don't necessarily amuse the palate, but certainly the mind and often enough the heart. And the overarching theme of these delectables is the title of our podcast and the subtext of your book title, which is called The Necessary Foreignness of Psychoanalysis. But within that overarching theme, you touch on a number of different areas. You touch on geography and architecture, terroir and science and mystery, and even polar bears. Now, we will get to the polar bears in just a moment, but first I want to read a few sentences about this concept of the necessary foreignness of psychoanalysis, and I'll ask you to elaborate on that, and then we'll get to your bears. You write, "Freud was a foreigner in the heart of the ancient Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it was from there, from the splendid isolation that the science of his time had condemned him, that he produced his formidable invention. The distance that being a foreigner gave him was not a minor ingredient in the formula of his discovery. It would have been difficult, I imagine, the discovery of the unconscious by someone who did not live the partiality of daily life, someone who did not maintain the necessary distance with any tradition. I do not think, we are in the realm of conjecture, that psychoanalysis could have been invented by a German from Berlin or an Israeli from Tel Aviv. It is from both a foreign perspective and foreign listening that makes it possible to notice the concealed underpinnings, to discover the new, and to express the unexpressed." And you earlier elaborated on this by writing, "This is what psychoanalysis does, which is a machine to produce strangeness. In response to the caricatures that can be made of our practice, though important, neither the unveiling of a hidden meaning nor the production of a new meaning is essential. What really matters is the breaking of all conventions in meaning." To repeat, what really matters is the breaking of all conventions in meaning. Mariano, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you very much, Harry, for the possibility to talk here, for your invitation to have this conversation together. We will try. First of all, I don't reject your call to poetry, even though it's an essay, the book. The presence of poetry in psychoanalysis, I think that is very important. Every time we interpret, we call something connected to poetry, and that allusive way of naming things that is present in your presentation of the book, I think it is very connected to the core of our clinical work. The book, through these small chapters, through those peals, if you want, of prose, but also with a poetic approach, try to grasp that idea of foreignness, which is not a core concept in psychoanalysis. When we speak about foreignness, many people don't know about what we are speaking. If we were speaking about repression or identification or unconscious, we know that we are in the field. When you speak about foreignness, nobody knows. And that's, in that sense, the concept itself, the idea, the word foreignness, has an opaque meaning. You need to approach to that concept, to that idea, but in an elusive way. And it's a concept that we can think in many other fields of knowledge, not only psychoanalysis. But within psychoanalysis, I think that is very connected to our core business, that is dealing with the unconscious. If you remind, that's a saying by Julia Kristeva, it's the unconscious what makes us foreigners to ourselves. So I think that the practice, the everyday practice of a psychoanalyst could be thought following that perspective. And the discipline itself could be thought following that perspective, with that concept that I'm not interested in explaining so much. I prefer to grasp it in different ways throughout our conversation, perhaps, instead of producing a definition.
Fair enough. Yes, that was my idea as well. Let me see if we can find some adjacent notions to foreignist. You say that it's not easily understood in the field. People do certainly talk about the asymmetry of the analytic relationship or the asociality of the analytic relationship, which sort of bump up against the foreignness in terms of their being outside of convention and certainly outside of the usual social contract. What do you think about that?
It's an important point, and especially living and practicing you in America, because I think that not only psychoanalysis, but the way in thinking relationship in America, perhaps is quite different from other continents. But some theoretical approaches that come from America have tried to highlight a kind of symmetry in the psychoanalytical bond. In my opinion, that probably is more connected to our Latin American way of thinking, if you want, or some theories that come from Europe. I think that the bone of a psychoanalytic treatment, a psychoanalytic conversation, a psychoanalytic relationship, is that there are not two subjects at stake, but only one. Even though we know about countertransference, of course, and we know that we as analysts are also human beings and subjects, but not there in the office with a patient. I think that our place there is more connected to the place of an object rather than a subject. And the only subject that is at stake there is the patient. So if you take that approach, you will see that special social bond that is the analytical bond, which is unusual. In no other places you can find a bond like the one we practice each day with each of our patients, where there is mostly one person who speaks and the other listens to, and when the other speaks, when the other interprets, he or she doesn't do that from a personal perspective, but from another one. It's the lines of our methods are quite strange. So that bond is essentially asymmetric, in my opinion, and that is crucial. That, of course, gives a lot of room to think about power, how to do or how to prevent that power will be used in that kind of bond. But at the same time, I think that that perspective enables us to think in the analytical treatment as a place of freedom, of no possibility of the direction of consciousness, if you want, no possibility of the influences we usually find in symmetrical types of bones. And of course, I don't think that the asymmetry has to do with placing the analyst in a kind of ideal place or a powers place, but rather the opposite, in the place of a minimal object to make room for, we could say, His Majesty the patient, if you want.
Just to be clear on this, because we know that patients come to us or in the course of their treatment discover that they have a foreignness from themselves, that they are so absorbed and almost satisfied with their presenting themselves through what they imagine are others' eyes or what convention would demand, that they've lost access to their authenticity, which is what the treatment is there to help them find in part. That's a sort of foreignness, but that's not what you mean. And I want to ask you to make that clear, the difference between what you mean and the character symptom of foreignness that patients often have for themselves.
Yes, but because as I have spoke in a kind of joke about His Majesty the patient, but the core of our work is to show in which way the king is nude. So to help the patient to acknowledge his or her own division. And there lies a kind of to be aware about his or her own foreignness. That is not to feel as an alien in everyday life, because we don't use analysis as a Proustian bed or a Proustian couch to make people fit to any social place or familiar given role or whatever. We try to listen to the difference and to listen even to the way in which everyone experiences himself or herself as an alien, but to convert that in something meaningful, in something important. I think that the best way to promote that is that to help people to be aware of the kind of foreignization that the presence of the unconscious produces in each one.
Speaking of that, it's a lovely segue to your polar bears. Why don't you share with us the story, and then I'll read a little piece that you wrote about it.
Oh, the polar bear story is a funny tale.
Yeah.
From the town where I live. I live in a city nearby, a city plenty of universities, and I was not born here, but I came here to study and then remained living here. And when I visited the city, I met a sculpture, a white sculpture made of stone of a polar bear. And then afterwards, I learned the story of that polar bear that was carried to different places in the city. That was quite strange because usually you see sculptures, for instance, in a square or in a park, but always in the same place. That polar bear moved from one place to another. And afterwards, I learned the origin of that movement. The tale was that in the beginning, many years ago, a bridge was built over the river that splits the city in two parts. The name of the bridge was Antártida Argentina, Argentine Antarctic. It was connected to the ambition, the aim of my country to own a part of the Antarctica, because we are near here and we explore there and we had many military settlements there and scientific positions there. But so that was the reason to name that bridge Argentine Antarctica. So a politician imagined that it could be nice to ask for a sculpture to place nearby the bridge. And he ordered to a sculptor to produce a polar bear. When the inauguration of the bridge, when that moment came, somebody said, wait a minute, there are no polar bears in the Antarctica. Usually polar bears are in the North Pole. So after that, of course, the polar bear wasn't placed near the bridge. And it began its movement throughout the city. It's when you see the polar bear, it's like it feels uncomfortable in every place it is placed. So I took it as a kind of metaphor, speaking about poetry, as a kind of metaphor mm-hmm. of foreignness. I don't want to take it in a romantic approach, because being a migrant, for instance, nowadays in the States, it's something very unpleasant mm-hmm. and it's not something romantic. And so that approach to foreignness, it's different, but there is a kind of discomfort in that position that you don't feed with any place. I think that this discomfort, this kind of strangeness is incarnated in a way, in a metaphorical perspective, by that polar bear in my Mediterranean city.
And what you write about it, let me read what you write because it's so clear. You write, what does psychoanalysis have to do with geography? Are they two heterogeneous fields, or can they endure joint reflection? Are they really equivalent to an unlikely encounter between the polar bear and the whale? You go on. The emergence of psychoanalysis more than a century ago in Vienna did not happen by chance. It arose as part of an artistic, architectural, and cultural rebirth, precipitated by a mixture rarely seen in history, where a whirlwind of thought that could only be produced as an effect of the miscegenation of the peoples that constituted the empire, of the fertile mixture of their spirits and languages, their religions and worldviews. At the same time, it could not have arisen without the decadence of that empire, because psychoanalysis has never gotten along well with official thought or political dogma founded upon unquestionable truth. Let me read that last part again. Has never gotten along well with official thought or political dogma founded upon unquestionable truths. That's what I understand for you the polar bear represents. It may be like, if you will, the fish out of water, but it's also very autonomous, and it lives in its own defined space, not simply in relation to the environment. Is that a fair representation of what you mean?
Yeah, perhaps. You began talking about the relationship between psychoanalysis and geography as two different continents, if you want, or species. You remember Freud talked about impossible encounter between the polar bear and the whale, and that usually happens between the field of geography and the field of psychoanalysis. For instance, we could think in what makes us members of the same organization, the IPA, and enables us to recognize each other, even though we live in different continents, as belonging mm-hmm. to the same profession, is what we share. And what we share, we could think that is It's, of course, a kind of training and the standards. And if you pay attention to that, the standards, we try to imagine as the same in everywhere of the world. That's a very important point in the life of our organization. Geography is, on the other hand, because geography always differs from one place to another. And geography, in my perspective, has a strong influence in the way in which the mind is shaped and in the way which we practice our profession. And it's a source of richness. I discovered that when I met an Italian colleague, also she belongs to the IPA. Her name is Lorena Preta, who invented a kind of group called Geographies of Psychoanalysis. She invited me to join the group, and we tried to take a look at that differences. And you spoke about a fish, and it's like like to that the work of that group in such a way is to be aware or to do some research about the water that is around the fish. And you know that the water is the last part of the world that the fish acknowledges. The fish doesn't know about the water. And it's something that we try to make it noticed.
And I would add, by the way, that Lorena Preta wrote an introduction, a lovely introduction to your book.
Yes. Lorena Preta has written the introduction. You are right. Because the book, the version of the book you have has been printed in Europe. There is another version which is in Spanish. But you are right. Lorena Preta has done it.
And it honors much of what you're saying here in a lovely way. Let me go on. There's so much time we could spend on each of these points, and we will get back to them. Your work circles around itself in a creative way. There's the question, speaking of, as you say, standards across the country and across the world, about the teaching of psychoanalysis. You write, there is a part of the experience of the unconscious that is transmitted and not taught. What is teachable is not what is fundamental. And although we can think of an analyst who effectively performs his function without having gone through strict theoretical training, although its importance is unquestionable, an analyst who has not gone through an analytic experience is unimaginable. You want to elaborate for us?
Yes, because for instance, you can think that what you learn in a seminar, and we do a lot of seminars during our training, is more connected to a knowledge. And a knowledge is usually taught, as in every discipline. I think that one thing that makes our discipline unique, so different from others, is that in the hard training process to become an analyst, there is not only not knowledge at stake, but also as an experience. And the main experience you need to be in touch with to become an analyst is the experience of the unconscious. And where do you find, where you face with that experience? Of course, in the analysis, in your own analysis. Also, you can think that in the supervisions that are more connected to analysis than to a seminar, in my opinion, can happen. But the core point is the analysis itself. And in the analysis, the place where you face the experience of otherness, the experience of foreignness, the experience of the unconscious that goes through you, it doesn't appear as knowledge. Of course, in an analysis, you get a lot of knowledge, but it's not the important aspect of an analysis. I think that in the analysis, and that's the idea of using that word transmission instead of teaching, what you receive is something that the analyst doesn't have. When you receive some knowledge from a teacher, you receive the knowledge the teacher has. When you transmit something, or when you receive something that has been transmitted by the analyst or by the psychoanalytical setting, if you want, is something that the other doesn't have. It's a kind of void. It's a kind of fire, if you want. It's like the
baton
that every runner pass to other in relay race. Is something more difficult to be grasped with words. It's something elusive to words, but it does exist. And so that's the reason that since Freud knew perfectly that it's very difficult to speak with a person to speak about psychoanalysis with a person who hasn't undergone a psychoanalytical experience. It's impossible. And there's the place where something that fire is transmitted, that experience of the lack of the voice, of the presence of the absence, if you want, takes place.
Mariano, we're not looking at each other now. And if we were, you could see I have a big smile on my face because there's something for me so pleasurable about this characterization you have that it's not that the analyst has something to teach and to give. What you're saying is the patient has something. They just have to, they need help to discover it within them. And that's the fire you talk about. And that for me is such a, now I see why I came up with poetry, such a poetic and graceful and powerful characterization of our work and what makes it so unique and so worthwhile all the time and effort we put into working in this area. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
But then you go...
Nice to listen to you.
Then you go, and this is my link, but it's in the book, to the issue of risk. And what you said, fire has risk. And you write, without risk, we are in the realm of self-certainties and blissful comfort. Be it imaginary complacency with oneself, between analyst and analysand, or among colleagues, or between them and their institution. Without risk, psychoanalysis would not have been invented. Without risk, man would not have abandoned the safety of caves either. Flesh out risk, if you will.
You know, Harry, I will tell you an anecdote. You know, in psychoanalysis in my country is very, very present. It's present in everyday culture. Cab drivers speak about psychoanalysis here in Argentina. And you know, the Pope has passed away some days ago. And even the Pope, when he lived in Argentina, had a kind of psychotherapeutical adventure, if you want. It's very present in the culture. And in the some decades ago, a saying was listened to, and a kind of definition. What is an analyst? And it was thought that an analyst was a Jewish young doctor who hates blood. That was a joke, of course, but at the same time, with some implicit lines in between these words. As if psychoanalysis didn't have nothing to do with risk. And I don't think so. I think that psychoanalysis is a risky profession, and we take risks. Sometimes, for instance, when we decide to listen to patients who are at risk instead of over-medicating them in a defensive way. We're taking a risk. When we listen to death in our patients' speeches, we are taking a risk. Where when we assume the discomfort of our foreign place, we are taking a risk. When we need to rediscover theory each time and invent it instead of applying knowledge as in many other professions, we're taking a risk. So I think that psychoanalysis is a risky profession, and following that apprehension of the profession, I think that it makes it far more interesting and lively and alive. And I like to mirror myself in the spirit of the pioneers, who were people who took a risk because they didn't follow the path of bourgeois profession or the liberal profession that we all of us make a living working as analysts in a world where psychoanalysis has gained a place. In my country, you can choose the psychoanalytical profession as you can choose to be a dermatologist, and you can trust you will be able to make a living of that. That aspect of the profession is different from the way in which the pioneers embrace our job. I think that their position was more risky in a good way, and of course, Freudian position. I like that very much. And I try to recover that spirit in my everyday practice. I want to feel that risk each time I receive a patient. I don't want to feel comfortable every day I arrive to my office.
And I think I know the answer to this, but my sense is that risk, as you mean it, isn't as others mean it in terms of using risky technical approaches to patients who are in the category of, shall we say, famously called difficult to reach. That's a great deal. That's a current interest, certainly here in the States, of how do you reach patients who are difficult to reach, where words don't carry the symbolic capacity that is our bread and butter. Is that what you mean by risk? Or I think you mean something else.
Yes, I think that I am trying to mean something different, because I think with severe patients difficult to reach, we must try, of course, different methods, but at the same time, taking into account that iron rule of or ethical approach to the practice in the core of our method, that is abstinence. It is a very complex rule, but what I mean probably has to do with another thing, that is to not take nothing for granted, making our gained knowledge, our tradition, which is quite rich, as a knowledge to be applied each time with each profession. Not assume that we are a profession like any other medical profession. I don't think so. To take a risk, to invent. And if you, for instance, Freud used to say that you need to listen to each patient, and more than that, to each session, as you knew nothing from the patient, as you have forgotten the last session. That position of not taking nothing for granted, that position of avoiding any knowledge, and to try, because it's an impossible task, to be open and free, is a risky approach. And I try to do it also when I write or when I teach. I think that there is a, an abyss between applying a knowledge, as it happens in many other professions, and reinventing the knowledge each time, as it happens in ours.
Let me read what you wrote on that very subject. You write, "In psychoanalysis, we find ourselves with a body of hypotheses of dissimilar epistemological value that seek to grasp regularities verified by analysts from over a century of experience and evidence from clinical practice. However, each case renders such universality useless, since uniqueness is one of those universal hypotheses espoused by the method. Each case is new. Each session with each case is new. And therefore, clinical experience cannot be the place where we apply and validate theoretical laws, but, in any case, where they are rediscovered. Each case in our science of the singular is destined to refute theory more than confirm it. We are interested in each case precisely because it does not adapt to theory." Now, let me ask you about theory, because you have something to say about that. And you write
about
the following about theory. Theory, yes. You say, "No doubt a practitioner needs theoretical coordinates to be guided in the clinical work. Two alibis, as common as they are deceptive, are offered to those who resist adherence to a certain school. On the one hand, the pretension that clinical work can function without theory. A clinic as a place of encounters and agreements free of differences is an illusion. And behind this supposed atheoricism, what is found is an implicit theory, which is not corroborated even by the person who holds it, a theory that is not put to any coherence test, almost a whim. The second temptation, that of eclecticism, conceals the same position and runs the risk of offering the practitioner alibis to justify anything in order to move away from a theoretical argument, only to anchor in another at the moment in which the former ceases to be functional to their scotomas or interests." What do you have to say about that?
Okay. It's a complex issue, Harry. But there is nothing like a virgin listening doesn't exist. Every of us listens from certain theories, and the more you are aware of the theories, the better you listen to. But at the same time, remember that when Freud used to say that psychoanalysis was a research method, an investigation method, a therapeutics, and a set of mm-hmm. theories, I think that many theories change. Of course, there are classics. As in music, we have classical music, we have classical theories, classical concepts. But I think that it's far more important the method itself. That makes our profession singular, because that confronts us to certain problematic field where we face, for instance, the place of science and the place of art regarding psychoanalysis. I think psychoanalysis in its history has tried to be accepted as a science. And among us, we speak about scientific papers, scientific journals, scientific mm-hmm. directors. It's usual, but I have spoken with true scientists, and no one, no physics or chemistry or doctor in chemistry, for instance, accepts, at least the ones to whom I have spoken to, accept that we belong to a science, that we are scientists, even though they can come to our offices and lie on a couch and analyze themselves. So our place regarding science and also theories is complex, is singular, is different. In my opinion, it's more connected to art, and in such a way we practice a kind of artisan work where singularity is at stake, and science is more connected with universalism. You need some approach regarding universal to build a science, and our science is a case by case science. So that's a problem to fit in a scientific approach. When we approach to a case, to a new case, the theory is put into brackets, and if you don't do so, you will apply that theory, doesn't matter which one, to the case, instead of being open to read the case and to help the patient, as if we had no theory within us. Of course, it's not true, but we must listen as if we are not applying theories. And at the same time, we work in a field where there is no homogenic theory. We didn't achieve a universal theory in psychoanalysis. Many theories orient our practice. We have many authors, and many of them don't dialogue among them. So, and even though the practice works, and you can see a session carried out by analysts in different parts of the world, orientated by different theories, and something happens there, something connected to the unconscious experience. So I trust more in the consistency of the psychoanalytical method, which is quite simple and has changed only a bit or nothing, nearly nothing, in 130 years, rather than in changing theories that are incapable by definition to understand its borders, its hidden places, its dark sides. So it happens to me with theories the same that it happens to me with languages. You know that there is a French author, Barbara Cassin, who says that you always need at least two languages to understand the determinations of your own language within you. And I think the same regarding theories. I think that you need at least two. And if you have more, better. But not in an eclectic way, not as an alibi you mentioned before, but in an organized work way, if you want. I don't know if that was your point or not.
It sounds to me, as I listen to you, that your notion of foreignness maybe can be translated or exists in relation to the familiar notion that analysts have of always being in more than one place at one time. That is, when we listen to patients in the present, we're also experiencing and thinking of their past. When we're hearing things extra-transferentially, we're also thinking about how it relates in the office. Now you're adding to that when we have theories and we have a foot in a theory, but we also have another foot or 2 feet in each, better said, in the moment without theory. And that is another version of foreignness. Yes? Does that sound that we're speaking the same thing, speaking the same language, as it were?
I'm not sure. I think that to me, foreignness is more, how to say, is near that idea of, I will put in this way, to learn how to listen the language of the patient, even though it could be your own language, as if it were not your own language, as if we were always listening in a foreign language. You know that Freud was called by a German author, Wolfarth, as a man from the, let's, I don't know how to translate correctly the title of the book, but it was a man that came from a foreign state, from a foreign place, together with Walter Benjamin and Franz Kafka. The three of them thought and read in German, and in a very good German. Freud was a magnificent writer, but his approach to German was made under a way which was studied by Deleuze and Guattari, not in Freud, but in Kafka, as something they call a minor language. So the German Freud was influenced probably by his Yiddish and his Jewish culture. So his approach to German in the way in which he wrote and thought was quite different from Goethe's one, for instance. He wasn't a German writer. That approach to the language, I think that was a core ingredient in his discovery. That is, how to make the usual something strange. And that has roots in, for instance, Shlovsky in literature, or Bertolt Brecht in theater. It's very connected to some contemporary arts practices, how to become the usual something foreign, something that triggers a question within you. Because that's another point. We need to make room to questions. There is a French writer I like very much, Maurice Blanchot, who said that an answer is the disgrace of the question. In our work, we try to make room for questions, and you need to make room for that. And I think that a good way to produce that is to introduce foreignness in the other's speech.
I understand the distinction you're making between that and being in two places, so thank you for that. But I want to add to what you're saying with a question at the end, which is, there's a great deal of conversation, certainly here in the States, may not be as much in the wider IPA world, but the role of the cultural background of patients and how that needs to be appreciated in some way that it is felt that it hasn't been appreciated in the past. And if I understand you, and this is going to be the question, you're saying that even if your analysand exactly matches on the surface your demographic, the same ethnic background, location, geography, education, all the things, cultural, religious, all the things that fall into the cultural ethos of our time, you're saying even or especially with that patient in an analytic treatment, one must feel oneself to be foreign to them in order to allow them to discover their foreignness, their self-awareness of themselves. Am I getting you right?
Yes, you are right. Because you know that we are trying to be aware as much as we can in this, in our contemporary discussions about the influence of power and race and gender prejudices in our practices. That is to be more aware about the water that is surrounding the right. Fish you were speaking before. But we cannot assume that the other is like we are, even though we live in the same quarter, even though we belong to the same ethnic group. I like very much the idea of difference. When it appears as an illusion of that we are equal to the other, we must introduce a difference. But you also include something regarding the cultural factors, and culture is a very complex word. To me, in my approach to psychoanalysis, I don't distinguish between, for instance, that is very commonly heard, between culture and clinic. I think that it's not like I am a clinician, but I like to go to the opera or to the theater, or I like reading literature. I think that sometimes when you read, for instance, to me, reading literature helps me sometimes more in my practice rather than reading a journal, a psychoanalytical journal. Sometimes it happens to me. And I try to think in culture and clinic, especially in our profession or in discipline, as if they were in a continuity, as in a there is a topological figure, at the Möbius strip, which has only one side. And there, clinic and culture alternate. And from that perspective, the culture and the cultural difference is always present, as culture is always present in human nature. You know that Lévi-Strauss broke that distinction between nature and culture, discovering that the human nature was a cultural nature. So it's a very interesting question. We could spend hours speaking about that, Harvey, but I think that we don't have so much time here.
In fact, I want to make sure that we have time for me to read, if you will, my favorite quote from your book. And you write, and it's under the category of anachronism, and you write, "The anachronistic should be understood here as the most authentic way of being contemporary, as Giorgio Agamben has emphasized. By neither coinciding with the times nor adapting to its pretensions, psychoanalysis is outdated and hence more able to grasp it. Those who excessively adapt to their own time cannot understand it. They are not contemporary." Let me repeat that sentence. "Those who excessively adapt to their own time cannot understand it. They are not contemporary. The anachronism of psychoanalysis intensifies over time. Perhaps some of our theories age or even expire, but our method of listening does not." What is so sparkling for me about that is, as much of what you write, it sort of delights in the counterintuitive, which is always fun, hence, again, going back to poetry. And you emphasize the method of listening, and you don't reify theories, because some theories obviously have been demonstrated to not be the best way to understand various aspects of the mind. And we, needless to say, learn over the past 100+ years that some things are more attuned to the inner experience than other things. But your point is, the method of listening does not. And is there anything you want to add to that, or are my comments sufficient about it?
I like very much what you have quoted about Agamben. It's also my favorite quote, because that I think it goes to the bone of our discipline, and the fact that it has survived for so many years, and we have gone through a pandemic in a quite good way. And that's certain relationship to contemporaneity. For instance, we are now dealing with the challenges of AI, artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I think that psychoanalysis will also survive that. And why? Because we are like that, the name of that drink, old fashioned. I love that idea of old fashioned psychoanalysis. Because psychoanalysis, of course, pay attention to that. We are recording a podcast. I have earpods in my ears. I'm in front of a contemporary computer, we are speaking with a Wi-Fi connection, of course we are contemporary in that way. But in another way, we are contemporary going against our times. We are going against our time and against the tide, against any kind of fashion. So that's I think that is the better position to an analyst, to understand the time. And that happens in the towards the inside of our discipline, towards our theories. To me, I have found many, many points of the theory that survive that better in the classical approaches, written a century ago, that in some papers written 10 years ago. So the place of the classic in our discipline is quite different than in science. In science, you don't use Newton to explain quantum physics. Newton belongs to the history of the physics. But in our discipline, it doesn't happen. We usually quote Freud, still nowadays. And so that's towards the inside, towards the outside world. I think that our position is the better one to understand the challenges of contemporaneity, that are many everywhere. And if we don't have certain success in understanding contemporaneity, that is to pay attention to the challenges of contemporaneity, to be able to understand wars, the pandemics, the changes in subjectivity, we won't join the conversation. We don't exist anymore to people. So I like to think in contemporaneity and in current issues, but from that old-fashioned perspective, that is, try to grasp the zeitgeist in an anachronistic way, but anachronistic in the way you have highlighted, Harvey, that it's not old, it's not merely old, it's a position to understand contemporaneity.
Grasp of the zeitgeist in an anachronistic way is could have been the other title of your book. Let me close with reading just a sentence or so from the last page of the book. You write, "Rescuing the trademark of foreignness that defines psychoanalysis from its beginning, and that nowadays is dizzyingly diluted, implies recovering a certain mysteriousness. Those who consult us believe that they pay to reveal a mystery, but they really pay for that mystery to exist." Mariano, I don't know what else I can say that expresses my appreciation for the way you think and the way you write and my senses about the way you work and the way you teach. It is it is a gift to the field. The book, again, the title is The Compass and the Couch, Psychoanalysis and Its Necessary Foreignness. It is a treat. I don't think my delight is only mine. I think others who read it will get similar, though their own pleasures from it. Thank you, Mariano. It's been a great pleasure for me.
Thank you, Harry. It has been a great pleasure to have this conversation, and I hope we will be able to go on with it. An unending one.
I look forward to it. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.